there's stigma and shame attached to it. I mean, a series of reasons why they don't come early enough. And so we do see a lot of late cases.
A new report documents the rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping and methodical. This is Tuesday, December 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Join us on any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, the UN Security Council holds its annual gathering to denounce human rights in North Korea. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Stay with us. The rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping and it's been methodical. That is the finding of an Associated Press news agency report after interviewing 29 women and girls who fled to neighboring Bangladesh. The survivors from several refugee camps were interviewed separately. The women gave AP their names but agreed to be publicly identified only by their first initial, citing fears they or their families would be killed by Myanmar's military. They ranged in age from 13 to 35, came from a wide swath of villages in Myanmar's Rakhine State, and described assaults between October 2016 and mid-September. One of those interviewed said the attacks were swift. She said 50 people from the military, 50 men came into the village, surrounded it, and stood in front of people's doors in groups of threes. They then entered into the homes and started pulling out young girls from their homes. They began raping them, and some came toward me and started beating me up. The testimonies bolster the UN's contention that Myanmar's armed forces are systematically employing rape as a calculated tool of terror aimed at exterminating the Rohingya people. The report found what it calls a sickening sameness to their stories, with distinct patterns in their accounts, their assailants' uniforms, and the details of the rapes themselves. The Myanmar Armed Forces did not respond to multiple requests from the AP for comment, but an internal military investigation last month concluded that none of the assaults ever took place. The AP report said, however, that they are stunned at the sheer volume of rapes and suspect only a fraction of women have come forward. Doctors Without Borders Emergency Medical Coordinator Crystal Van Leeuwen said she expects many more rapes than those already reported have most likely occurred.
Since the 25th of August, in our facilities, which, you know, we're in the camp in 15 or so different locations, we've seen 94 women come forward for care of some sort related to sexual violence. The majority of the women are reporting that this occurred in Myanmar before they crossed in, and the stories that they're telling us, and that not only the victims themselves, but that other people are telling us about witnessing acts of sexual violence in Myanmar, make us feel that we're only capturing a very small proportion of the victims.
And that, says Leeuwen, is leading to treatment that is coming too late for many.
There's stigma and shame attached to it. I mean, a series of reasons why they don't come early enough. And so we do see a lot of late cases. The majority come after physical injuries may have already healed, that we've missed the window of opportunity to provide the prophylaxis for sexually transmitted infections and HIV. And we do see some women presenting pregnancy-related concerns, seeking medical care for pregnancy, and that pregnancy was a result of rape.
The AP report adds that although the scale of these attacks is new, the use of sexual violence by Myanmar security forces is not. Before she became Myanmar's civil leader, Aung San Suu Kyi herself said Myanmar's armed forces used rape as a weapon to intimidate ethnic nationalities. Yet Suu Kyi's government has not only failed to condemn the recent accounts of rape, it has diminished the accounts as lies. Many of the victims worry they'll never return to their villages. One of the victims told AP reporters that they wanted to wipe us out from the world. Unless we get what we are searching for, recognition of Rohingya, we will not go back. The Associated Press reported this story with a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. China fails to block a UN meeting on North Korea human rights. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan start a missile tracking drill. A Bangladeshi man with a homemade bomb strapped to his body set off an explosion at a New York commuter hub during rush hour Monday morning, wounding himself and three others. And China's leader launches an investment deal in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. The United Nations Security Council met on Monday to discuss human rights abuses in North Korea. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, said if we truly care about prevention, human rights has to be at the heart of it. VOA U.N. correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us from the United Nations now. Tell us more about this, Margaret.
So, Ira, this is an annual exercise. It's become an annual exercise discussing the human rights situation in North Korea in the Security Council. Now, that's not the normal venue for human rights discussions at the UN. Usually, they're either in committees related to the General Assembly or in Geneva at the Human Rights Council. So some council members have an issue with bringing this subject into the council, and others, the majority, say it's important because you can't separate human rights and conflict prevention.
So what was discussed?
So we have the Human Rights High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zayed Raad Al Hussein, and he spoke about a number of things, but really one of the big issues he's concerned about is the impact of economic sanctions on ordinary citizens in North Korea. He wasn't advocating the repealing of those sanctions necessarily. He was just saying that the Security Council should perhaps periodically take a look at them and assess them and make sure they're not hurting North Koreans who are already struggling to get by.
The humanitarian assistance provided by UN agencies and others is literally a lifeline for some 13 million acutely vulnerable individuals. But sanctions may be adversely affecting this essential help. For example, controls over international banking transfers have caused a slowdown in UN ground operations, affecting the delivery of food rations, health kits, and other humanitarian aid. I ask that members of this council conduct an assessment of the human rights impact of sanctions, and that conduct or that action be taken to minimize their adverse humanitarian consequences.
Now, there were just a couple, two or three, I think, I do believe, countries, members of the UN Security Council that expressed some kind of opposition to all this?
Right. So since this started in 2014, this move to bring human rights into the Security Council, China has regularly tried to block the meeting, and they do that through a procedural vote. So it's a lot of, you know, UN sort of theatrics, and there's a vote, but they always lose it, and then the meeting goes ahead. So it was China, Russia, and Bolivia that objected to the meeting. Ethiopia and Egypt also abstained in the vote, so they were kind of neither here nor there. But you just need a majority of members to have the meeting, and so that it went ahead.
Does this have any immediate effect on the world situation?
No, it doesn't, but it shines a spotlight on the issue, which, you know, is getting buried behind the nuclear issue. And that was what one of the other briefers mentioned, that, you know, don't obscure human rights. Don't let it get obscured by the attention that's being placed on security and political and issues right now. And I think that's important. And yesterday, Sunday, was International Human Rights Day, so it's sort of tagged around that on the calendar.
Now, also at the UN headquarters in New York, outside of the Security Council, there was something else happening dealing with Korea. Is that correct?
That's right. The United States and six other countries co-hosted a meeting about human rights in North Korea, and they brought a defector to speak at the meeting, a woman named Ji Hun Na, and she was caught three times trying to escape from North Korea from the time she was a teenager, and she had, you know, horrible experiences in North Korean jails, and she was sent to a re-education center, and she was forced to undergo an abortion. I mean, she just had all sorts of human rights, gross violations of her human rights, but she's, you know, an amazing success story because on her fourth attempt to get out of North Korea, she did it, and she made her way to China and eventually to South Korea, and today she's an activist and an author, and there are 30,000 people who have left North Korea successfully since the mid-1990s, since the famine, and made it to South Korea, and so she's now one of them. And one of the issues she really focused on is the concern about forcibly repatriating people who escape North Korea, that if they make it out, the Chinese should not send them back, and that's what China does. The South Koreans don't, obviously, but China does, and the High Commissioner for Human Rights said that in the past year, his office has received more than 70 reports of North Koreans who escaped to China and were returned home after the authorities there ruled that they were economic migrants.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. Thanks for being with us, Margaret, from New York.
Thanks, Ira.
Happening now in Asia, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, said in an interview that the full U.S. Olympic team would participate in the Winter Games to be held in South Korea in February. However, she again left open the possibility that heightened security concerns could force the U.S. to reconsider the commitment. The rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping and methodical, according to a report by the Associated Press. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. More than a million college-educated immigrants in the United States are in low-skilled jobs, that according to estimates, but they have trouble finding work in their professions, including in the U.S. tech industry, which desperately needs skilled workers. A special technology industry job fair this week in San Francisco brought together refugees and new immigrants with potential employers. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
Job fairs are routine here in San Francisco, but this one is special. 50 new immigrants and refugees hailing from countries including Russia, Iran, and Eritrea, looking for work. Khalid Turkmani is from Syria with a degree in computer science. For his first 9 months in San Francisco, he worked survival jobs, selling shoes, assembling furniture, developing websites for $10 an hour.
When you know, like, the same work that anyone else who's born here will get paid $50 an hour, it's like it was super painful. But on the same time, for me, like, work is work.
Turkmani, who has asylum, went through a program at Upwardly Global, an organization that teaches skilled immigrants and refugees how to search for a professional job in the U.S. Here, he learned about networking America style, and now is an IT project manager.
Here in the United States, you are expected to look directly into someone's eyes. And when you meet someone, you have to give them a firm handshake. All those show confidence.
Recent immigrant job seekers have to learn a new way to talk.
Well, they say the team, we, the group, the company, the organization. But in the United States, that is very different. People talk about, I did this.
Ivan Vislov, a Russian immigrant at the event with his wife, expected tech jobs would be easy to find when they arrived in Silicon Valley.
We are professional. We are professional product manager and business analyst in IT. Field. That's why we came to the San Francisco.
Vislov plans to follow up with Yelp, TaskRabbit, and others. And he plans to network at hackathons and job fairs. He has to. For Vislov, giving up is not an option. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, San Francisco, California.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The White House spokeswoman says a pipe bomb explosion in New York City's subway system Monday shows the need for immigration reform. We'll have more on that story in just a moment. Law enforcement officials say that man came to the U.S. from Bangladesh 7 years ago with a type of preferential visa for people with relatives who are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. This is VOA Asia. Accusations of espionage and political meddling are straining relations between Australia and its biggest trading partner, China. Speaking in Mandarin, the Prime Minister of Australia, Malcolm Turnbull, has used unusually strong language to criticize China over alleged interference in Australia's domestic politics. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has insisted there's been sophisticated foreign interference in Australia's domestic politics. His government has cited the example of Sam Dastyari, a senator for the opposition Labour Party, whose close ties to a wealthy Chinese businessman have come under intense scrutiny. It's alleged Dastyari allowed the man to pay a legal bill for him and has spoken out in support of Beijing's official policy on the South China Sea, in defiance of the Australian Labour Party's position on the issue. In Canberra, a senior government minister accused Senator Dastyari of being a double agent. In a statement to Parliament last month, Iranian-born Dastyari insisted he was a patriotic Australian but wasn't without fault. Turnbull has used unusually strong language to insist that his country wouldn't be intimidated by the Chinese.
Modern China was founded in 1949 with these words, Zhongguo Runmen Zanchi Lai, the Chinese people have stood up. It was an assertion of sovereignty. It was an assertion of pride. And we stand up. And so we say, Adalia Runman Zanchi Lai, the Australian people stand up.
Australia has introduced new laws banning foreign donations to political parties. Those who meddle in Australian democracy on behalf of another nation could also go to prison. China has said it's lodged an official complaint over Turnbull's declarations on foreign interference in Australia's affairs. At a scheduled briefing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Geng Shuang said the Prime Minister's comments were unacceptable.
We are astounded by the relevant remarks of the Australian leader. Such remarks simply cater to the irresponsible reports by some Australian media without principle and are full of bias against China. It poisons the atmosphere of the China-Australia relationship.
Analysts say Beijing's ultimate aim is to ensure Australia becomes more pro-China and distances itself from the United States. However, they suggest that Prime Minister Turnbull's strong words have shown that Canberra is willing to stand up to China. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, while Australia's close military ties with the United States date back to the early 1950s. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner has called on the Security Council to assess the impact of economic sanctions on North Korea to minimize their impact on millions of already struggling North Koreans. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. U.S. President Donald Trump said today or Monday that the homemade bomb attack in New York City that authorities said was carried out by a Bangladeshi man highlights the urgent need for Congress to enact immigration reform legislation. Trump said in a statement the suspect had entered the United States on a family immigrant visa, benefiting from a U.S. policy known as chain migration, which the president says is incompatible with national security. Now a little more on this alleged attacker. The Bangladeshi suspect is an angry former limousine driver who learned to build a bomb on the internet at his Brooklyn apartment. That according to police officials. Ariad Allah, who's 27 years old, is in police custody after he was injured by the bomb he fastened to his torso with Velcro and zip ties. After dominating industries like textiles, electronics, and mobile phones, powerhouse China is setting its sights on a new sector. Experts predict that by 2020, the country will rank just behind Spain as the world's biggest wine market, fueled by both domestic production and foreign imports. That means training Chinese students to cultivate their palates and their business acumen, as Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Dijon, the capital of the East Burgundy region.
Nowhere in New Zealand's far from the coast. The coolest area perhaps is Central Otago.
Learning about New World wines in one of the planet's oldest winemaking regions. This afternoon's class at the School of Wine and Spirits in Dijon, France, offers a virtual tour of winemaking in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and California.
So great varieties.
There is one country that is not covered, at least not yet. China, home to nearly one-third of the student body here at the School of Wine and Spirits Business.
Okay, so here is the map of New Zealand. What do you need?
Lei Shu wants to become a wine buyer for a Chinese company.
Actually, the wine culture in China now is not very good because most people, they don't know how to taste the wines. But so we still have a long way to do and to teach the Chinese people how to taste wines, how to enjoy our wines.
Cabernet Merlot, very important. Merlot, this is one class.
Students here are learning about every aspect of the wine business. For Chinese like Shu, they have plenty of work ahead.
They want to go back home with the best practice in order to be able to produce the best wines they can.
Director Jérôme Gallo runs the wine school, which is part of the Burgundy School of Business in Dijon.
And probably not in one century, not in 50 years, in a decade or two decades, Chinese, some of them will be alumni of our programs, Chinese people will be able to produce very qualitative wines at a large scale.
China is not just producing wine, it's also a big wine importer. Rich Chinese are snapping up French vineyards, mostly in the southwestern Bordeaux region. But Chinese tourists are also heading to Burgundy to sip and buy bottles from another prestige region. Dijon wine merchant Adrien Tirelli says he tries to share his passion about wines.
Chinese people, like all the new consumer, just learn in the guide. And then they come with the books and they tell me, I want this one, this one, this one. Perhaps like the Americans 15 years ago.
But things are changing quickly, partly fueled by rising incomes. Student Yishun Hao says that while older Chinese stick to domestic wines, the new generation is more adventurous.
They are more open-minded to the French culture and French wines, so maybe they knew much more better than the old generation. But for the like upper class or middle class people, a lot of people, they want to consume wines from different regions like Orientale. They're trying to discover new things, and it's kind of a symbol of wealthy and a luxury thing for them.
Okay, great varieties. Cabernet Merlot.
The school's research director, Steve Charters, agrees things are changing fast.
The Chinese wine industry is developing rapidly. The quality of their wine is improving substantially, and they are learning what works well.
Even recently, in the last 30 years, has been a big...
It seems only a matter of time before China will be the next star of this New World wines class. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Dijon, France.
And that's going to wrap up our program for this day. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and on SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you and find us at voanews.com. Let's hear from you as well. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Jimmy Cook, the managing editor of VOA Asia, Diane Gao, the VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, David Bird, Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a marvelous day ahead.